Heavenly Father, thank you for this evening. Thank you for the privilege we have to gather and in a few moments really to hear in testimony the truthfulness of these three songs we've just sung in one individual's life. And Lord, would that testimony encourage and strengthen and give vision to each and every one here gathered? Lord, the cost is not identical, but there's a cost to following you. And Lord, I know perhaps almost every heart in this room tonight already believes that that is a cost worth pursuing. But if any is unconvinced, would you use this testimony, accompanied by your Spirit, to persuade that following you is worth it? We pray in Christ's name. Amen. Amen. Well, welcome. You can take your seats. If anybody's strolling in from the hallway, just find an empty seat. Thank you so much for making your way here tonight in a relatively short period of time announced opportunity. And Allie and Caleb, thank you so much for leading in worship. Before I even go on, just a few things that you may already be aware of, but just to be clear, this would not be a time to post in live time where you are and who you're with and what you're doing, okay? So please no FaceTime posts, no social media posts while we're here gathered, okay? That would be wonderful. It's been a little less than 3 years ago when our own John Stemberger put this book, Hiding in the Light, in my hands, and I shared with Rivka over dinner that I don't believe I've ever read a book as quickly as I read this book. I could not put it down. I put it down to sleep one night, and that was pretty much it, and I finished it the next day. Now, that's not my attempt to make a plug for the book, but if that helps you, if that encourages you at all, great. But it's just such a powerful testimony of what it means to follow Christ. In fact, the very last section of praise in this book before you get into its body comes from our own John Stemberger, and it seemed fitting to turn the privilege over to John to introduce our new friend, our guest, our speaker tonight. So John, would you come and take that honor, please? So if I can do this without losing it, that'll be good, because when you go to law school, you dream about taking cases where you're really fighting for justice and fighting for the underdog, and this was a remarkable journey that I thought when I volunteered to do a single hearing that it would just be a one-time thing, but it ended up being a life-changing event for me. But first of all, I want to thank you all that do support our ministry and my private law firm, because as a result of your support, I was able to be released for multiple months to assist Rivka. And so thank you for that. But I get a text probably once a week or multiple times a week, depending upon the level of crisis in the week, from this young lady. And so we have become more than just a client or a friend. She's become a part of our family. And so I feel like in some ways, we never said this, but we kind of have a father-daughter relationship in a lot of ways, so it's been neat. But Rivka Berry is the author of really a New York Times bestseller. It happened almost in 2 weeks. The book is remarkable. I will put that you have to have the book. And the only thing better than the book is the audiobook, where she, in her own words, with great emotion and fear and trembling at points, tells her story, and it's just really a remarkable story. I thought I knew the story representing her for multiple months, but there was so much detail that I completely missed. And she speaks all over the country for a pretty hefty fee. And so her appearance is a gift here to us as a body. And so we really appreciate that, Rivka. But there's one place in the book that's kind of cute, and it only has special meaning for me because it says, you know, John represented this case, and she says, if only he knew what was going to happen. And there was quite a bit of trauma that happened to me in the case, including being sued and being grieved by the Florida Bar, and actually being in the hospital with a transient ischemic attack, which most of you don't even know about, occurred at the time because I was not looking to advertise it. But it's just a lot of stress. Everybody who's an expert on Islam was talking to me and all this. And I've had the question asked to me, if you had it to do all over again, having paid 30 grand to defend your law license and being sued and drugged in a federal court in Ohio for defamation and everything that's happened, would you do it again? And without question, I mean, because of the fruit that God has placed in this young lady's life, she's been able to minister to untold hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people around the world. And in fact, Random House, when I was talking with her agent, said that this book is downloaded more than any book that they have. We believe Muslims around the world are actually reading it quietly on their electronic devices. So please give a warm Metro welcome to my good friend, Rivka Berry.
Thanks for having me, y'all. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Maybe it's just on my end. Is this okay? Okay. It is definitely an honor to be here. I love sharing my story. Well, there are hard parts to it, but I especially enjoy sharing it in front of youth, just because that's really where my story began. Oops. John, can I have my book? I'm sorry, I'm just going to keep a note on where I am, because this page keeps flipping. Well, so my story, I'm just going to jump right into it, begins when I was a little girl. I grew up in Sri Lanka, and Sri Lanka, if some of you don't know, it's a little tiny island under India. And as a little girl, I really had, you know, you grow up and you don't really know anything different than what you're living in. But looking back now, I lived in incredible oppression. And but first, the two key points where my pain began were two big things. One was I was blinded in my right eye in a horrific accident that occurred. In a situation like that, you know, most of you in this room would look at that and have deep pain and sorrow for someone that's gone through an accident where they were blinded. But in my family and in the culture I come from, the blame is not cast on the blame is cast on the person that they're experiencing. So I was then seen as this picture of imperfection, and it was this kind of scapegoat circumstance where all of their issues were pinned upon me. Oh, thank you. And another big circumstance that happened was I was sexually abused as a child, and again, this is a circumstance where you in this room would look and have pity on the victim, but the blame is cast on the victim. You know, you've done something wrong. So these two events were huge for me as a child, growing up where, as a 6, 7, 8-year-old, you're given care and affection. Instead, I was the blame for things. So as I got older, I took the pain and I said, okay, I'm going to be religious. I'm going to do my duty as a Muslim and become the best Muslim that I can. Right, so I remember fasting starting age 7 in the month of Ramadan, which is pretty intense because, I mean, you're going for a whole month fasting from sunrise to sundown with no food or water. And then I remember an imam, which is like an Islamic leader, would come to my house and teach me how to read in Arabic because you read the Quran in Arabic and you memorize parts of it. So growing up, as I took on the blame, I just saw life as that's just what life is. And so I continued to follow Islam and do my duty as a Muslim. But it got to the point where the abuse escalated. It got to the point where the beatings increased. It got to the point where I'm 12 years old and thinking, if this is what life has to offer, I don't want it. I am thinking about suicide. Just to give you a little bit of a picture of how real the shame is, my parents left the entire country of Sri Lanka, everything that they had known. I mean, my parents had lived here for all their lives. They have, you know, relatives, generation after generation, they left all of that to run away from the shame of the sexual abuse and the shame of the eye. So to give you a picture, this is the kind of life that I grew up in, the blame. So I came to the States, and I knew no better, so I continued giving myself to Islam. And there came this momentous time in my life where I'm actually quite about 12, 13, your age. There's many of you in here who are teenagers. I remember being in school. I was in math class, and there was a girl named Angela Jim, and she just came up to me, and she says, "Hey, are you a Christian?" And I have no idea why, but I say yes. And this is, I come from a Muslim background, Muslim heritage, fasting, prayer, like all of it. And maybe it was because I wanted to be liked by her. I have no idea. I said yes. And she's like, "Oh, great." You know, she's just talking Christian language. And I'm like, yeah, that too, yeah. So I didn't know what I was doing. But pretty soon as our friendship blossomed, I told her the truth that I really come from a Muslim home and my family can't know. But again, not a Christian at all, but she invites me to church. And I have this momentous moment. This is the first time I've ever been in a church. I'd heard about it, but I'd never set foot in it. And even as a child, I knew the risk. I knew that people who had done much lesser crimes, such as, dressing more Western, having boyfriends, or doing things that are culturally not appropriate, would have horrible consequences. So how much more converting? But I remember thinking when Angela asked me to go to church with her, if I'm already willing to commit suicide, to take my life, maybe there's something worth actually dying for, right? And I was so hungry for truth, so hungry for an answer. Why am I here? Why does my heart beat? Why is it that I am aching for an answer? There has to be something more that I'm here for than just waking up one morning, doing the same thing over and over again, and just going to sleep, and then you die, and then what happens? There has to be something more that we're created for. And so those questions and longings led to a point of just abandonment, and I said yes. And so being at the church, I had a profound moment where my parents didn't know anything about my desire or interest for Christianity, and I lied to my parents, said something like, "We're going on a school project or something," and, which I don't condone lying, but in that circumstance, I was forced to. Which, to a point, I really struggled with my morality as I became a believer, lying to my family, yet following the Lord. It just was such a difficult tension living in. So I came in, and my glorious moment that I always tell people, I know everyone's story is different, probably many of you grew up in the faith, but I can pinpoint that moment where all of my longings, everything I had been waiting for my whole life, was answered in that single moment. And it was that moment where, actually it was kind of funny because I think my friend pushed me to the altar call. I didn't even decide to go. She was just like, "Oh, you should go." She's like pushing me. I'm like, "Okay." So I'm just like walking up. But before I even get to, I didn't know why I was there. I had no idea. I just knew that I was so hungry for truth. But I remember that moment where I had neglected all of the pain, everything that my family had forced upon me, the blame, the shame, this awful sense of unworthiness, the sense of you are merely an object to be owned. That is your existence. You will amount to nothing. And everything that had been fed to me, I remember staring up at that cross in that one moment. It was as if God was breathing in my brokenness, and I was breathing in his beauty and grace. And not to say that life actually got a lot harder after that moment, to be quite honest. But it was this moment where I knew I encountered a God who was bigger than me. And I didn't know who this God was. Actually, I forgot this essential part was months prior to that moment, I remember, again, enduring another beating, and I got to my knees, and I said, God, if you are real, show me who you are. If you're Allah, if you're Buddha, if you're Jesus, whoever you are, I will follow you. And months later, little did I know that that one instance, this random conversation led to a moment that would change my life. And that was really the beginning of this incredible, agonizing journey of saying yes to Jesus. I just want to take a moment here to kind of talk about Angela's role. I know Angela was brave, and I think sometimes in the Christian walk, especially for young people, there's this sense of you should be evangelizing, you should be going out and telling other people, which, yes, but the key is what was different about Angela, y'all, is her heart was filled with him. She was so filled with him that she could not contain it. And I saw that. Like, it wasn't this, like, I need to invite you to church, so I'm checking you off my list, you know? Like, it was so real to her, and there was real tensions, real struggles, real identity crisis, but she had a relationship with Jesus. And that is something I want to encourage y'all, as I've gotten to know more, you know, obviously being in the church and interact with other young people, is I worry about cultural Christianity. You know, how much of your faith is your own journey with Jesus, and how much of it is just living off your parents. And I'm sure that's also talked about, but what was profound to me about Angela was how much she prayed. I mean, we would go into these prayer meetings. She's actually Korean, so she went to Korean church. They would pray for hours. Like, we're talking like all night long. They'd just sit there and pray. And I saw the fruit of that. I mean, she really lived for another world. And that was evidenced by what she desired, you know, the way she lived her life, the music she listened to, the love that was evident in her life. So anyways, this moment kind of projected me into this journey after saying yes. I actually, if I really knew, I would not have gone into that church. And what I mean by that is, if I knew that Jesus was a man, I would not have walked into that church. I remember almost feeling like I had just been, like, cheated. Like, Jesus is a man? Like, you believe God is a man? I mean, it was so offensive, but I see God's grace in first winning my heart, and then understanding theology and how he came to save us. So I really learned the gospel later, but it was a journey, years of hiding my faith from my family. So for about 4 years, I would get up in the middle of the night and I would pray. That was my only way of communicating with God, because I couldn't just listen to worship music, you know, while I'm in the car, you know, car with my dad. Like, you know, there's such a... So I guess maybe I'll take this time to kind of explain the risk. So in the Islamic books, there is a statement that if a man leaves his faith, then kill him. So the cost is not just abandonment, which in some families that does happen and there's no physical violence done to them, but the shame, again, going back to remember the shame, how my family left everything, the shame is so great that they're willing to take any risk to cleanse their shame. So much so that the Islamic faith would demand, if my parents wanted to overcome the shame, to take my life. And that happens all over the world. There are believers, Muslims, who say yes, knowing that their life may be in danger by the very hands of their own families, their brothers, their mothers, their sisters. You leave everything. And I didn't really know what, you know, when you say yes, you really realize, oh, you know, cost-benefit analysis, here's all the things you leave behind. Absolutely not. But, you know, when you fall in love with God, it's like you find why you're here. When you connect with the creator of the universe, everything changes. The cost doesn't become cost. It's like you can't even imagine a world, you know, not having that. And so I just did what I did. I hid my faith. I would sneak out to prayer meetings. And as I continued to make these decisions, you know, I remember distinctly there were moments where God would ask me to not be in certain friendships that I was in that were incredibly not helpful for my faith. And, you know, there would be moments where it was like, okay, I probably shouldn't be listening to this type of music. And so there was my faith required, and I believe the gospel asks this, are evidence, you know, fruits in your life where there are evidence that your heart has changed. And I started seeing myself changing slowly. I no longer, you know, thought the same way. Life was different. There was a real change. You know, even when I got in disagreements with my mom and maybe I said something I shouldn't have said, my heart grieved. And so this struggle with my sin, and I saw this evidence. And so as time passed, there really became kind of a moment of truth where I had to either stand for what I believed and take on the risk or recant everything I had experienced and just live a simpler life as a Muslim. And so how the events occur are incredibly, well, crazy, and also hard for me to share, to be quite honest. And so the book has a greater detail, but to give a brushstroke, my father eventually found out. Over the years, there were little things they'd find that I lied about, that I would say, oh, it's for a school project, oh, it's for this, but they knew that something was different because I had changed. And so eventually my dad found out, and he gave me time to recant in a very horrible interaction with my father. And after that interaction, he went away on a business trip, and the mosque had found out and taken matters into their own hands. They had done their research. Basically called my mom and said, if you do not deal with your daughter, we will. Which I knew what it meant. It was, again, the honor thing. And so my father cut his trip short, and I knew that he was coming back. And in a crazy set of circumstances, I found myself in a bus to Orlando, Florida. So kind of how a little snippet of how that happened was, I was awake in the middle of the night. There was a lady that I had no idea who she was. I had heard of him because heard of her through a friend of mine who was in the youth group. And she messages me and says, you know, I've been praying for you. It was like 3 a.m. I've been praying for you. You know, there's a wall of fire around you. And I just strongly felt I needed to call this stranger. So I did. And so we're on the phone, and I said, you know, will you please pray that in the face of death, I will not deny Jesus. And, you know, she's offering her home, and I'm like, my dad's going to find me. There's no way. So then I reach out to Brian that night. I'm just frantic. My friend who's in the youth group and who's older, is like a brother to me. And he says, we need to contact Beverly. He has no idea that I had just spoken with this random lady that evening, in the middle of the night. So through a crazy set of circumstances, we created this scheme of Brian coming to get me and going to Orlando, Florida by myself for 3 days. And so I did. When I got here, I really didn't know just how drastically my life would change. It was just one of those things that I knew what I needed to do, which was I was not going to deny Jesus. So I wrote a letter to my family. I said, Jesus Christ is my Lord and Savior, and I will never deny him, nor will I ever. Something like that. And I said, I pray and hope you find his mercy and forgiveness. I love you both. And I left home. And that was 9 years ago. I think I was 16 years old. So that day is a day that I think is still kind of a shock to me. A lot has passed, you know, now graduated college and looking at life ahead. But I just want to take this moment to say, I think the weight of that decision, I feel more standing before you today as a 25-year-old than I did as a 16-year-old. And our lives are vastly different. You know, God has called us to different things. I've been asked to give up a lot. And your life is going to look different. But my hope is that as I share the rest of the story, that you hear God's call of faithfulness to you and to give your life wholeheartedly, however that looks like, whether that's you going to school every day and saying yes to Him, whether that's you loving your children, whether that's you loving your husband, like whatever that looks like. There was a horrible turn of circumstances. I went to the people in Orlando who loved me very well, but I knew the time was coming when something would give. Because there's missing news reports all over Ohio going on. And here I am in Orlando. And so eventually to protect the very people who had helped me because I'm a minor, we ended up calling DCF. So I can't believe I'm even saying this, but they took me to jail. Yeah. It's kind of funny now looking back. Not kind of, I don't know. It's still weird looking back in that moment. But I actually have not done this before, but I want to share a little bit of my experience when I went there. I've never done this. But the cop didn't arrest me then, but he took me in, and then I waited for hours in this one location where it's like this. You're quarantined. I was then handcuffed and then put in this corner and told you cannot go anywhere. And I look and I see these jail cells where there's predominantly African-American men in these cells. And they're all actually, I remember some of them were moaning. I don't know what they were doing. And just horrible place. And then I'm transported, so I'm chained from my waist to my, there's chains going from my feet to my waist to my hands, and we're carted like animals, chained to a group of people, chained, and I see, you know, we're put in a van, and it's amazing. It's a very colorless place because I remember seeing color for the first time after a long time. Everything's just gray, and I was like, could not take it in. It was just so shocking to my vision, but you have a shower that is like 2 minutes long, cold, where they check you beforehand physically, and you're thrown into these like cement blocks. Everything's cement, and there's these bright lights in there, and the screams was what really pained me. There would be screams all night long. And these were young kids. They're like 13, 14, 15-year-old. And you can imagine, I'm like sitting there, and I'm so angry at God. I say, why are you doing this to me? Why? I've always said is yes. I've done everything you asked me to. And now you are putting me in this prison, in this little cell, where I can't have my own Bible. I can't. They took everything away. And they give you your own outfits and stuff. And just, it wasn't even my own pain. It was just the pain everywhere around me. These people who I knew had lived lives that were horrible. And so afterwards, I remember being taken up into the courthouse. And it was actually beautiful. At one moment, there's like jail school. And thank you. It's very kind. Thank you so much. Where I got the chance to, actually, I don't even know if it's in the book. There was a few girls, and they're like, "Girl, why are you here?" And I'm like, "Jesus." You know, they're like, "I don't know why you're here." You know, they're sassiness, and I'm like, "Well, let me tell you about Jesus." So there's literally like a group of girls gathering around me. They're like, pull their tables. They're like, so I'm just telling them my story of how I found Jesus. And it was really sweet. There were a few girls being touched, and I'm literally taking over the classroom. I don't think I've ever shared this. This is crazy. But It was amazing, and I made friends, and so that was really sweet. And they call me for my meeting, and I'm like trying to make friends with everybody. Like, they don't know what to do with me. All the guards are like, "Why are you so happy?" And I'm like, "Jesus." Person. But yeah, it was, but my beautiful moment, I think, was when I was in the jail cell just crying, so angry at God. And there came a moment where I heard this visible voice where I knew Jesus was like, "Will you sing to me?" And I was like, "Sing to you?" Like, no, like, how dare you even ask me that? Kind of sassy. But, and then I remember, like, thinking of songs, and I sang the song Heart of Worship, and as I was singing, there's this real reality that, you know what, I can encounter the greatest of sorrows, the harshest of fires, and it's okay. They can't take my life. Even if they do take my life, I know who my Father is, and I know who loves me. And that really, for me, was the marker moment where it just broke, where it's like, there is this resilience of, I don't care what you do to me anymore. Even if I get sent back to my family, even if the most horrible circumstance happens, I am okay, and I will do it, like, go in the name of Jesus. And so eventually, I did not, as a 16-year-old, you never expect your life to go on national television. As cool as that it sounds, it's really not. Like, let me tell you, no. Like, it's really not all that great. It's actually horrible where all these people think that they know all these things and create lies, and it's a whole different story. But my life is kind of thrust into the national news, and part of that was because the attorneys sitting in that courtroom wanted to send me back to my family undercover. Just like, oh, just send her back. Just send her back. Like, you know, she's just a runaway teenage rebel. That's why they put me in jail. So instead of treating it like an abused victim, they treated me like I was a criminal. And so one of my attorneys came up with a plan of, we're going to take this to the press and we're going to get everyone involved so that anything that happens, we're going to be able to see it. And thankfully, it worked in my favor, where it became kind of a national outcry of protecting me, which is incredible. So it was really confusing as a 16-year-old. I mean, having all this attention, you know, when you're in middle school or high school, you know how, like, you always want to be liked and be popular, and of course we all long for that, but it became this, like, almost internal, I can't even describe what it was like. It was as if even when I walked into a room, I thought that people were talking about me, because it was like that way for so long, where I couldn't even go anywhere without people taking pictures or whatever. And it became so self-inflicting. I don't even know how to describe it. And it's been beautiful because the Lord has actually now used that to show me my pride and my fear of man and my longing to be liked by people, which we all have longings for, you know, for that. And that can be good in some ways of, you know, bringing unity. But I really, especially now after writing the book, it's been an exposure of my pride, and God has used it to open my eyes to the one that's not seen and to show me the beauty in the hidden place. So I've really loved that, learning that. And so eventually, as my story moved forward, there was kind of a custody battle from Florida and Ohio fighting for my life. And in the midst of all of that, I was in so many foster homes. I think I was in like 8 homes in 8 months. I was living in a suitcase, and there were some amazing homes and there were some horrible homes. The horrible home was the one where there's the words, "Get me out of here," on the window, and a hole in the wall of the previous person that had tried to punch their way out. Horrible. Yeah, that was in Ohio. So, yeah, just really horrible circumstances. But, you know, especially since I'm talking to young people, life is full of so many different seasons. You know, you're going to have great joys, and you're going to have great lows. And for me, the key and hope is finding that anchor in the Lord. And so God used that. The horrible circumstances were an opportunity to grow in my faith and to keep being faithful and to keep choosing Him. And I can tell you, it was all of those circumstances that I walked in them that make me the woman I am now. You know, there is a path of either bitterness or there is a path of like gold being refined. And so I just want to encourage you that whatever it is, whether it's the heartache over the boy you like, whether it's, you know, I don't know, a family member dying, whether it's not having anything at all, whatever it is in your life, let it be an opportunity to press into knowing Jesus, because He has something there for you to learn. And, you know, especially in middle school and high school, there's definitely a longing to just fill yourself, at least I have that, whether it be through other people, whether it be through drinking, I mean, whatever. And really, it is a mirage that what you are looking for, you will only find in Him. So in the chaos of the foster home, in the chaos of the national press, in the chaos of simply trying to finish high school, I was diagnosed with cancer. They said, you have less than a year left to live. The condition you have is so bad that it's generous for us to say a year. So it was, again, another being thrust into this whirlwind of, is God good? Look at everything that I walk through. Is He good? Is He who He says He is? And I have to tell you, you know, the world can look at my story and say, no, He's not good. He is not a good God. He is unjust. He's this, He's that. But I don't have answers of why I had me walk through all of those things. But I can tell you, I have been changed by the God that walked with me through those circumstances. And to some of those young people, I hope this is kind of a depressing thought, but I have experienced more doubt now as a 25-year-old than I did when I was younger. But in the same coin, in the midst of the temptation and the doubt and the to accuse God, and honestly, sin in certain ways, because the pain is so great in my heart where I just want to release. In the same way, I have found Him to be there, to walk with me through those days. And I know, even if being national, you know, figure it all, whatever, being a public person, even if I were to walk away, do something I shouldn't do, I know He would still be there. And that is the kind of God we serve, that no matter what you do, no matter how far you go, He will pursue you. He will continue to love you. He will continue to be there and show Himself to you. And you may never see it. And so I am now so here and continuing the journey of the little yes I said when I was 16. Big news. I don't have cancer anymore. So I actually decided to stop the chemo early, which was kind of a death sentence. But my doctors were shocked that I chose to do that, but really strongly felt that was the path for me. And so, praise God. But I am, after the story happened for about 4 or 5 years, I kind of, some of you said, have, you know, said to me, oh, we didn't hear from you for a long time before the book, and really took about 4 or 5 years to heal and recover and process some of the things that happened. And I went to college, got my degree in philosophy, loved it. Fun fact, you know, coming from a background that says you have no voice, you have nothing to say, you are merely an object owned, And then every single day for 4 years, you know, being pressed by professors, what do you believe and why do you believe it? Show me the analysis of these arguments, you know, whatever it is, and tell me where the loopholes are. I found my voice. I found that God has made me with a mind that can put the connections together, can see loopholes and connect, make those connections. And so I'm looking into law schools and hoping to use my mind and intellect to fight for those who were once in my shoes. So one quick thing before I close, I was just thinking of a few things that I've learned, especially for during my younger years. And there were three quick things I wanted to share. One, I learned to give into the process. I think especially as someone who's younger, you really want to see results fast. Like, okay, I want this. Like, let's see fruit. Let's see prayers answered. Let's just keep going. At least for me, that was the thing. And I just want to encourage you that God is the God of the journey. And so as you walk through this phase, there's going to be a lot that you go through, highs and lows, and to have patience as you wait on him and let him work in your heart. And you, if you say yes to the journey, the long haul, and just being faithful day in and day out, that's the battle right there. So one, give into the journey. Two, surround yourself with people who you want to become like. That was one of the biggest decisions that has changed my life is, you know, there is a place, I think, for evangelism. There's, of course, a place of God placing different kinds of people, but especially in your time and your age that you're at, you're very susceptible to be molded by who you're around. And so surrounding yourself with people who are willing to be honest with you, willing to hold you accountable to the truth, willing to fight with you when you need to be fought with. So that was huge. And lastly, there's power in prayer. I am who I am today because of my prayers. And in that, what I mean by that is, you know, God gripped my heart, but then the response of talking to him. And think about it, like, how can you get to know somebody that you never talked to, right? And I think even my love for my family that has lasted has been through praying for them. So I would really encourage you to ask God to give you a heart for prayer and watch it change your life. Thank you.
Give Rivka's voice just a moment, a little break, a little water break. I forgot to mention, some of you got the message coming in, but young folks up front, you've got a pen and note card there just to try to frame your question, and we'll come to those in just a moment. So adults, if we defer the kids first, and if they've run out of questions, we'll go from there. But John mentioned it's not only her book, but the audio. There's just a little excerpt we want you to hear from that, and then we'll go right into the questions. Okay, so take a listen.
This audio program is presented by Audible.com. Audible, audio that speaks to you wherever you are.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Hiding in the Light. Why I risked everything to leave Islam and follow Jesus. This is the author, Rivka Berry. To my precious baby brother, Muhammad Rajab Berry, I can only imagine the unanswered questions that may plague you. Why did the big sister you adore leave you and never come home again? My hope is that this book is a long letter explaining why. Although you may never understand my answer, My prayer is that the words found within these pages allow your heart to heal. My prayer is that one day you will forgive me for the pain I have caused you. I left not because I did not love you enough. I left because I encountered a God who is worthy of forsaking all, even the most prized little man in my life. If only you could peer through my dreams and see how I ache to hold you in my arms like I did so many years ago. But this time, I never let you go. Between 2009 and 2010.
So that's just a piece of the audiobook, and it's extremely powerful. You see the first couple minutes. We're going to do a Q&A. Just a couple things. No questions about where she lives right now or about her personal dating life or anything like that. That's top secret security clearance stuff that I get on a regular basis. But feel free to ask questions to her about any of her story or whatever. She'll tell you if it's off limits. There's not much that she won't talk about. But you want to go ahead and get her back to here if she's ready for that. So, any questions real quick that you have for me before we continue on? She's really a remarkable person, as you can see. She's very fun, and she loves gummy bears, and she cracks up, but then you ask her to pray, and it's like Esther just dropped out of the Bible. It's like, whoa, very powerful.
Yeah. John, how did you get involved in the case?
So I had Congressman Micah call me, Representative Eisenhower call me. All these people started calling me, John, we need your help, we need your help. I said, look, I don't do dependency. I've been a guardian ad litem for 13 years. I don't have a command of dependency, and I'm not going to enter a high-profile case. A law professor and an expert in dependency from Miami called me, a woman, and she said, I'll write the briefs, you just litigate the case. And I said, okay, I'm in. And I thought it was just going to be one hearing. I didn't know it was going to be a several-month ordeal, but that's how I got involved. So, all right, Rivka, you go.
Oh, do I use this?
Yeah.
All right, this is the scary part where let's let you ask anything you want.
All right, so if you have any questions and you're with the Alive Youth, have you guys written it down? Anyone written one down yet? All right, well, you guys think about it, write something down. When you have something, just raise your hand and I'll collect them and then we'll get to you guys. Does anyone else have any questions to just start us off with? Just raise your hand if you have a question.
Hey, Rivka. We just got John's side of how he got involved, and of course he's very humble and he doesn't get into details. But the first thought that came to my mind as we were asked for questions was, "Hey, she didn't talk about John getting involved in her life." Mm-hmm. So, in your words,
absolutely.
How did he come into your life?
Sure. It's really funny because they just gave me a card with the name Stumberger on it, and I kept laughing. That sounds like hamburger. But I was 16, living in that home, but he by far was my favorite attorney because he would always bring me gummy bears. I was like, I like him! So, first he came into my life and there was oddly a lot of resistance to his presence. Oddly, because normally, to have a counsel, which is an attorney, is very normal if you're in the court system, but to give a little explanation, the court gave me someone called a guardian ad litem. Now, in the court size, that is somebody who represents your, quote, best interest. So they can deem whatever is your best interest, they will fight for it. So John is whatever I want. He'll fight for me. And so I didn't really know what to think of him at first, but he came into my life, guys, as things progressed. He has been my greatest fighter. I look back and I have cried multiple times thinking about how much he means to me because, after leaving my family, I lost my greatest connection. I think about even little things like baby pictures and the fact that they've known me for so long. Like, they knew what I was like when I was 4, 5, 6, 7, and I can never hear what I was like as a child. And as I get older, it grieves me knowing that I'll never get that. But John has been in my life the longest of anyone I've known since that time. So he's been a tremendous advocate and friend and father to me. But that's how it started, with gummy worms and hamburger.
All right, another question. Someone raise your hand.
Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
You have a Wikipedia article about your case. In that Wikipedia article, it was a quote from a professor in religion. And his comment was, some people just need to have an enemy. If he was here tonight, how would you reply to him?
Okay, so you're saying you were reading on Wikipedia and, yes, and on the what professor said, some people just need to have an enemy?
Right.
In reference to, like, me just having an enemy?
You know, people were attacking the Muslim faith.
Okay, so people attacking Muslims, kind of this idea of,
yes,
this difference of maybe culture and faith.
Right, how would you answer him if you were here right now?
Yeah, I would first say you didn't live in my shoes. So it's very interesting looking at academic, you know, understanding of how we evaluate cultures, but then when you look at a experiential circumstance, what a testimony of an individual that survived something is going to be different than when you look at something academically and have theories. So that would be my first thought. I think we're all broken, so yes, there is that sense of difference, but I can only speak for myself, maybe not other people. So I would say my experience was vastly different. I was a victim of abuse victim. And so it wasn't necessarily about having an enemy. It was really a cultural oppression that I faced.
Okay.
Yeah.
That professor was my brother.
Oh, wow. So, that's your brother.
So I will tell him.
Yeah, and you tell him.
How has the Muslim community from that you knew in Ohio reacted to your book? Or do you know of anybody?
This is why I have, normally when I travel, I have a bodyguard with me. They don't know where I live. I don't know what their response has been. I know they were incredibly angry when the case happened and made clear of it, but I really can't answer that because I have no idea where or how, you know, if they've known. I mean, who knows? They might have plans, but I just have no idea, you know. So, yeah.
You had mentioned meetings. Is that something you can talk about?
In some sense, I mean, it's, yes, really hard to talk about when you are talking about physical abuse as a child. I guess I will say this on that note, is something that I'm experiencing now is what abuse does to a person is it disintegrates their humanity. It makes them not a human being. And so even as a 25-year-old, I am still struggling with its effects. I mean, y'all, there are decisions sometimes that I have to make, and I literally think in my mind, I don't have the option to. It's this weird, twisted, so even though you're out of the circumstance, you still act like you're in it. So it is a horrible certain thing, but on a lighter note, what I've done as a result of kind of facing through some of the physical, my step in physically healing from it, is I have started something called Krav Maga, if you guys know of it. It started with the Israeli secret police. I love giving this feel. started with the Israeli secret police, and it takes all forms of martial arts, jiu-jitsu, boxing, wrestling, and it takes out all the formalities. It's the most brutal form of self-defense there is. Like, you'd kill someone with it. And I go 3-4 times a week, and I kick butt. All these guys, let's go. These giants, and they fight with me, and I fight with them, and you, that has been humanizing, you know. So my whole life being taught you are worthless, and your existence is to have pain inflicted upon you. That is your worth, right? And so in Krav, in martial arts, you learn how to fight and say, no, I am more than this, and I'm worth fighting for, not just with someone else, but myself. So when I walk down an alley, I also feel much more confident that I can really hurt somebody, and I'm like, let's go!
Alright, I see some of the Alive students writing stuff down, so just a reminder, if you got a question, just raise your hand and let me know. But we'll take a couple more from people in the back.
Hi.
Hi.
So, just this past decade has been so crazy for you, and you know, your relationship with Jesus is just so beautiful. Just the way you hold on to his truth. And so I wanted to know if there was a particular passage of scripture that, as you were encountering all of these trials, you held on to and really preached to yourself.
Thank you. There are many. My two favorite that come to mind is the passage in Philippians where it talks about our suffering is creating in us an eternal weight of glory. One of the things my story has done for me, and that passage is a reminder, is we're not here for just this physical existence. You know, God is using, has tailored our suffering for us to become the most beautiful bride that he has. And so it reminds me there's so much more. So even though I don't see tangible, redemptive things in this world, and I never will, I'll never get the 8 years from, 9 years from that I never got to see my little brother grow up. I'll never get that. But God is using that to create in me this greater glory. And so there's that passage. And then the passage in Psalms, the Lord is my portion, my inheritance forever. And that really comforts me that he, as I walk through this life, in lack or in abundance, he will be enough.
Thank you so much for your story tonight. It's affecting me deeply. Yeah. Have you had any, what contact have you had with other Muslims that have converted to Christ because of your book, because of your story?
I know a lot has happened, but I don't personally get to meet them one-on-one. There's a Facebook I have, which there's a lot of messages on there, but I never get a chance to read because there's so many. There have been, I've heard through the grapevine, through my story, or people who have been kind of on the verge but really were propelled forward through my story. So thank you for asking. I think a lot of it too is I don't get to have interactions with Muslims much because of the danger. So my ministry is really just standing from afar, speaking or doing radio outreaches that go into the Middle East or other places. So I never really, I don't really see the fruit of that in terms of salvation.
Here you go, Dustin.
How old is your story?
How old is my story? You mean like when I left home?
Yeah.
That was 9 years ago.
And then, how long have you been a Christian?
I have been a Christian for about, like, during my 12 years. 12 or 13 years. It's hard to really pinpoint, you know, well, when was that point, but it's about 12 or 13.
Have you had any contact with your family or your parents whatsoever?
As they get older, that's something I think about more and more, knowing that they're getting older and I'm getting older. And their presence is very much missed in certain big events in my life as I get older. So yes, I'm open to it. I don't quite think the opportunity has come for that to happen. I have not had any contact except for my brother, where he had messaged me. But it got pretty hostile or not friendly, so I kind of had to back away. but I pray for them a lot.
Actually, I had a quick question.
Sure.
You know, just as we hear your story and just your faithfulness in the midst of just such high cost, I imagine many of us are thinking through how we're called to be faithful. And I just imagine many of young adults, high school and middle schoolers, just thinking through, they're not facing the same kind of consequences. But how would you, what would you say to them about how they can be faithful in the places they are in their life right now?
Mm-hmm. I would say pursue God with abandon. And let me just say, I am who I am, not just because of the decisions I made, but because of my walk with God. Because, like, the same situation could have happened, but if God had not won my heart and I had not been persistent in some of the spiritual disciplines, I would have easily been angry and bitter and not responding in a way that's godly. And so this, you know, it's not like, oh, Rivka's better, so the Lord gave her these hard things and now she can overcome. It's, we've all been, God knows you. Like, he knows it so well. Like, he knows exactly what we need. And I think, you know, the spouse you have, the parents you have, the children you have, like, all of those things are tailored to sanctify you. And so what does faithfulness look like? Love him and love the people around you. Love him. That means, let's talk practical, disciplines, you know? Prayer. Prayer has been life-changing. Fasting. I think it's been a long-forgotten discipline that, for me, has been life-changing. So fasting, prayer, worship, you know, all of these things were the things that we're doing are feeding us, you know, are feeding our spirit, feeding our souls, the things we watch, all of those things have such an impact on our spiritual journey. And not to make it legalistic, but really, I think that's one of the beautiful parts of Islam even, is I was taught at a very young age holiness. You know, this deep sense of right and wrong, this deep sense of hungering for God, thirsting for righteousness. And so, you know, I've fed on the word like it's no one's business. And I just cried out to God in prayer. And that became slowly my delight, you know, where other things that were not as beneficial. I love what John Piper says. And he says, even good things, simple pleasures can numb our desire for the Lord. And so it's, you know, learn to read. It's like a marathon, you know. You don't just think you're going to train and all of a sudden you just get great. You've got to go to the gym. You got to work out. You know, there's get up early in the morning. So there has to be tangible changes. And again, I don't want to be legalistic in this of like, the Lord will have his way in your life regardless of your obedience or rebellion. You know, but there is a real response of how you choose to respond with the resources that you're given. Your time, your energy, your money, your resources, your mind, your affection, everything you are. And then so loving part, pretty easy. You've been given a family. You've been given a mom and a dad. You know, some of you have been given a spouse. Like, you do what the Lord has asked us, which is love God and love your neighbor as yourself. So as you feed on him, you're going to be trained, transformed, and then be given opportunities to die to yourself. So I think as you embrace those two factors, God uses that to chip away the darkness, to transform our mind, transform our heart, where we love what he loves and hate what he hates. And so I think those two things are pretty transformative. And you don't need to walk through what I did to experience that. You know, that's through what you've been given, you know, in your daily walk with God. I mean, even now, I live a pretty normal life. Like, I go to school, I have friends, normal things. And so I think those are two aspects.
Great, thank you.
Hi. When it comes to, from the things that I've read about Islam, it seems that everyone, no matter like what stage they're at in their faith in the Islamic faith, they take it very seriously. Some to the point of groups like ISIS and Al Qaeda.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But when it comes to Christianity, we seem to be lacking sometimes. What would you say to that? Just in how the two religions compare, but how would you encourage Christian groups not to go to the extent of Islam, but keeping God's word holy in the way that Islamic people would keep the Quran?
Interesting question. If y'all know who Nabil Qureshi is, he was like a dear brother to me, a very big part of my life. He sadly passed away last fall. But he wrote a book called Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus. And that's something we've talked about, actually, is some of the strengths and weaknesses of Islam and why we're kind of crazy is because of, you know, where we come from. But I think that kind of goes back to some of what I talked about, really, of when you do what the gospel asks of us, which is, you know, the diligence in prayer. And I think that is the biggest struggle the American church has, is comfort. Yeah, everything is very comfortable, and it's sometimes even harder than being persecuted because you have this clear choice of either follow or not. So in the comfort, then I think awareness of your temptation to be passive in your walk with God. And I think the real acts of disciplines that I've talked about doesn't just come from yourself, but crying out to God to change you. And as the Spirit is after your transformation, he's after all of our hearts to be made into his likeness. And so really just crying out to him, he's the only way. It's not by checking off the list like Islam requires or the diligence, but it's the Lord. So great question.
How is
Jesus
different from the
Pharisees?
I know this is probably a question for John as well, but just how he was saying something about how you got sued from the Islamic. I was just curious to hear more about what happened with that, whether you guys wanted to share about it.
John, you can take that one. Pass that over.
So yeah, the Islamic lawyers in Ohio filed a $10 million defamation case in a federal court in Ohio. And my nationwide insurance carrier didn't cover that. But I had to go through a deposition and just be a part of the process. And they claimed that they were defamed by me appearing on Fox News multiple times regarding the case and all that. And then the Islamic lawyer in Ohio wrote a handwritten complaint called a grievance, a formal complaint against a lawyer in pencil, calling me names. And the bar, instead of dismissing it as a bogus thing, cobbled up three allegations and put my law license through a formal trial, which is it's went through multiple committees and then has to go to a judge for a trial. And I had to hire counsel for that and pay out of my own pocket. There was some assistance from Alliance Defending Freedom, but I refused to settle the matter because they realized, I told my lawyer, this is not going to be an ordinary case. I'm not going to just resolve this because we're going to show everyone that I did nothing wrong. So as we got closer, they kept saying, well, just pay this amount of money and we'll settle the case. I said, no, I'm not doing that. And my lawyer's begging me. And I said, he said, just sign this apology and we'll dismiss the case. I'm not signing anything, I said. And then the final thing was sign this joint dismissal to jointly dismiss the case. I said, I'm not dismissing the case. They can dismiss it on their own. He was begging me. He said, no one does this. Please just dismiss the case and we get it over with. I said, no, we're going to try the case. And so they finally ended up dismissing it, several later. And then the physical part of it was I was driving home on our anniversary and I just lost all memory. I didn't know who I was and where I was supposed to go. And in my mind, I kept thinking, I'm having a stroke, something's not right. And I didn't know what the next thing was. Like, I wasn't sure who I was or where I was supposed to go. So I managed to somehow get home and ended up in the hospital for a couple days. And having four little kids look at you and say, Daddy, you're going to die, is a pretty dramatic deal. But Adam Master has been an amazing gift to me because he's really took me in a whole other place physically. But it was a remarkable journey for me in that regard. But to see what Rifka has been able to do is just simply worth all of that.
We have time for two more questions.
Hi. I just wanted to ask you, from the length of time that it started, like when you actually got arrested, to the end of the trial, what was that time period? Because, you know, when you're watching in the news or you see things on Facebook or whatever, you know, it seems like it either drags out forever or it doesn't, but like what was the length of time? How many months or years or whatever till it was complete?
Before I answer that question, I love Batman. That is not my shirt. Batman! Actually, I joke that John's Batman. I'm like, Batman, where you at? He's so crazy. Like, he does everything. Like four different institutions, like, running them all. But, so July 19th, I believe, was when I was taken. I left July 19th. It was sometime in the end of July or August that I was incarcerated. And then
2009.
And then 2010. It wasn't until August 10th, my birthday, that the case disappeared. Because essentially, it was the main issue was that I'm a minor. So the two states are fighting for jurisdiction, right? And then they're battling, even when I get to Ohio, they're battling for me to be in their custody since I'm a minor. So the minute I turn 18, under Ohio law, it just becomes an issue because I'm an adult, legal adult. So there's no longer a need to fight about legal custody. So I was trying to stay as a foster care, you know, system. So about a year, I would say.
I think somebody filed a lawsuit. I didn't understand.
Against John?
Oh, okay. So you know him for 9 years?
Yes. So they filed a lawsuit after the case happened. I mean, it was just really ridiculous because, my attorneys who were incredible, and like one was a law professor, and they were like, I don't even know how this guy got his law license. Like, just basic stuff that he would not be able to do. So. I think the lawsuit was just kind of a effort to get money out of the whole thing.
Hey, Rivka. I was going to ask, how would you compare the love of the faith that your parents wanted you to have versus the one that you have now? And can you compare the love that you experienced from the faith that your, you know, parents called you to love versus the one that you discovered by yourself with the help of your friend?
Sure. I guess experientially for me, it is, of course, vastly different. Who you see today is a vibrant, alive, joyful Rivka. Actually, if I had stayed a Muslim, I would be very different. It's crazy because even after converting, it took years to uncover even my personality. Like, I always thought I was an introvert and didn't like people, so I was always just in a corner. But then in college, I'm like, I'm an extrovert, I love people! I can't be the only friend! I'm just like, walking around. And so I've come alive as a human being, not just in my faith, but in my gifts. And, you know, I play guitar, I sing, I swing dance, like all those things that I wouldn't be able to do as a Muslim. So I've come alive as a person, not just by experiencing the love of God, but in a much more broader way, where as a Muslim, everything about me would have been stifled. You know, you're not allowed to dance, you're not allowed to sing unless it's the Quran, you're not allowed to express yourself, and I was beaten for doing so. If I was too loud or too animated, too whatever. So they're vastly different. It's almost like freedom and oppression, slavery. You know, that's kind of what it felt like.
Oh, one last question here in the back.
Hi. I just had one question, and I'm just curious. I'm not like nitpicking or pointing fingers at you or anything, but because honestly, I wouldn't either. But my question is, who do you fear most, and have you forgiven them?
Who do I fear most, and how have I forgiven them? Have you forgiven them? That question kind of assumes that my fear is my family, right? I don't fear my family, actually. Who do I fear the most? This may sound cheesy, but God. no, really. Like, that has been my biggest prayer over the years, is I want to tremble before Him and Him alone, and I fear God. Have I forgiven my family? Yes, but that does not mean the pain is erased. Forgiveness, I think, yes, but it's continuing. You know, forgiveness is a daily, constant choice in my heart. So it's hard because there's no, like, tangibles. Like, how have you known when you've forgiven someone? Are there, like, manifestations that you have forgiven them? I think forgiveness is a process, and I think forgiveness equates to wrestling with forgiveness. And I'm definitely doing that. I think it's not as easy for me since I don't have a physical connection with my family. They're not constantly there, you know, to like where I'm confronted with, wow, you've hurt me. So it's more so being willing to go to the painful places. being willing to remember the painful memories and being willing to not just forget. That's my way of forgiveness and walking in that journey of healing. Great question, though.
Well, I want to give us an opportunity to do something Rivka talked about, and just if I can just piggyback on that as one of your pastors, I'm not going to preach, but what she just said about forgiveness is worth praying over, whatever your situation may be. Forgiveness doesn't depend upon the other party even knowing they need it. It starts with you and God, and you just heard a powerful demonstration of that. But Rivka, you talked about loving God and loving our neighbor, loving others. Here's how I want to ask you to love your neighbor in a few minutes. In a moment now he's going to come. We're just going to sing one more song because you like to sing.
I do.
And then Shane's going to close some prayer. But here's the love your neighbor part. Rivka's going to be in the back. Books are available tonight. They're $20. Here's how you love your neighbor. You know when you're in line behind someone and you're just hoping they'll stop talking so you get your turn? Let's love our neighbor by not being that person. Okay, so don't turn that into a question and answer time so that as many of you as possible can just say hello. And if you'd like a signed copy of the book, it's $20. We're the church. We trust you. If you didn't come with it tonight but you want to take a book home, could you just tell me you're good for it? Okay, thank you. Wow, I think we're in church. Okay, so you can take care of all that in the back in a moment. But thank you so much for just sharing just a portion. And I will unashamedly tell you to grab the book or the audio because I'm listening to Rivka share and I'm like, take it back into the book where you develop things further. And you'll be so encouraged. I would tell you this, though. Try to find some time to start it when you can stay seated for a little while because that will be the impact of the book on you. So before we worship, can we just thank God again for working?